Hi, thank you for the invitation, and hopefully I can entertain you a little bit right after lunch. Give you a little overview of some things related to designing crop varieties for lignocellulosic ethanol production. The biofuel research that I work on is funded by a DOE through our Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. So I'll throw in a few details about some of the things we do and talk a little bit about some of the things in the center. As I go through this presentation, my most direct collaborator is Natalia DeLeon, and we also work with Mike Kassler and Robin Biel's group quite a bit on our research, so they should be acknowledged as well. This image, I think, is a way to start. As a country, as a scientific community, we're trying to find a way to go from this oil, so this is a gushing oil well, and big cars and so on, to a much more sustainable type of energy system, the biofuels, small cars. And the reason I like this image is you can see that there's a path emerging, but you can also imagine that there's lots of currents. And there's currents that are scientific currents, political currents that are shifting this path around. And the exact path that's going to take us from this point to this point has a lot of impact in terms of how we address the problems in terms of crop improvement. From an overall standpoint, when we look at this developing biofuels industry, there's a number of steps that are important in the process, and these are the steps that are outlined in the DOE information that's come out, the way that we're attacking this problem. If you look at the center diagonal here, our focus is, of course, on biomass production. That's what a lot of this session will be about. And then that biomass, if you're going to go to ethanol, you need to have a deconstruction step, and then you have fermentation to ethanol or synthesis if you look at possibly later generation biofuels. And so there's lots of research in all these areas. And in terms of being a researcher, nobody likes factorials. So we like to look at hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of genotypes, and we'd like to have one step in this process, one way that the deconstruction is going to occur, one set of enzymes, one fermentation organism. And similarly, for other researchers in our group, they would like one feedstock, but ideally one type of corn, one type of switchgrass, so they can look at their factorial or to their various possibilities for deconstruction, enzymes used in the process, and similarly microbial biologists. And so this becomes a very complex process because no step in the process is fixed. It's very hard to decide exactly what to focus on in many cases. In terms of lignocellulosic ethanol, this goes across many, many areas, not just the scientific research areas. POET is one of the first companies, I believe, that's getting into this fermentation in a larger way. There's a lot of discussion about using cobs, but more recently it looks like there's going to be cobs that are baled up with other types of stover material. And so engineers and companies that invested in cob collectors maybe lost some money on that investment. Similarly, if you look close to home and close to my area, some of the first use of biomass is the Charter Street cogeneration plant on campus or on the edge of campus. And there's going to be a conversion of this cogeneration plant from coal to biofuels. And of course, as this is developed now, there wasn't questions about genome sequence or about what varieties. The practical concerns were what biomass is available, who can pellet it, and how many trains can come into Madison at one time. And so all of this type of thing we're thinking about is going to be somewhere down the road, and really we're looking at a moving target. Also across all these areas is sustainability, so various energy concerns, various carbon concerns, ecosystem services. This is a figure prepared by our sustainability group that shows conceptually, and has been the basis for a lot of discussion within the center, conceptually of how we might be moving from low diversity, high input crops like continuous corn to rotations. These aren't, of course, an extensive or a complete list of all the species, but examples along this continuum of things that might become more sustainable. And some of the themes here are to use perennials, have perenniality introduced into the system, increase diversity, and the perenniality and diversity might be within a field. So you might have multiple species in a field, if you look at restored prairies, for instance, across the landscape or across systems. But some of these themes have some big impacts on how we proceed. So just from a higher level, there's been lots of speculative investment into different crops, breeding crops, both in the public and private sectors. There's substantial efforts on species that aren't crops at this point, but have the potential to be crops. And so this has a lot to do with how we invest our time, how we invest our efforts, and it's a good question of which crops will predominate. Of course, there'll be many species for various regions and so on, and the choices will balance energies, balance the concerns about energy, economics. And one thing I thought was quite interesting is this issue of perhaps public sentiment or some of the things that we don't think about. So this picture on the bottom left-hand side is the road in northern Wisconsin that goes into my parents' cabin. And if you can see on the left side of that picture, they'd come in and they'd log that and they used this chipper. They took the trees and they put it all through the chipper and haul it away on semis. And everybody in the community there was upset, and they're writing letters to the Department of Natural Resources and so on. And said, well, right. Talking to my family, I was explaining to them, well, it's biofuels, this is the type of thing that's going to happen. I told them a little bit about pine trees and poplar trees. And my mom says, I'm old. When I drive down that road, I want to see trees on both sides. So, you know, there's the logic, there's the scientific arguments, but there's all these other issues that come in. Another issue that as we move towards perenniality, when we look at improving varieties, we can expect a consistent improvement in varieties over time. And this is a graph for corn. There's graphs for other species. Of course, the rate is different. I would say that in some of the newer species, like switchgrass, you would expect that gain to be pretty good because there's a lot more effort now than there had been in previous years. When you look at stands of crops, of perennial crops, the investment in the planting is amortized across the period of time that crop is in the field. And in addition, the energy benefits are amortized across the period of time. So from a sustainability standpoint, you would like to have things growing in the field for as long as possible. But in terms of releasing new technologies, releasing new cultivars, there's going to be some kind of trade-off between stand longevity and introducing new varieties. If we do approach something like restoring prairies, such as was on the continuum that I showed you on that first slide, we might begin thinking about breeding for mixed species plantings. And so as breeders, as geneticists, we think that there's a best variety for any particular location. And so again, we end up with this factorial type of situation. How do we find the combinations of best varieties if we're going to do breeding and do improvement? And so there's some types of things that have been thought about a little bit by plant breeders, but maybe not extensively. It's not clear if this is going to be the ultimate path, but it's the type of consideration. And similarly, there's similar factorials when you look at cropping systems, alternative rotations, harvest methods, and so on. You have all these different possibilities to test, and it's very hard to think about all those possibilities as you're developing crops. So then some specific challenges for plant breeders and geneticists, kind of in the context of what I talked about. Traits and weights, defining selection criteria, phenotyping and logistics, and the characterization of genetic variation. And I think on the next slides I'll talk about this. So of course, the yield per hectare still is an important trait. So whether you're going to burn the biomass, whether you're going to ferment it into ethanol, that's a very important trait. Quality is a very complicated trait. The exact path that you're going to take to produce energy from this biomass has a big effect on quality. If you're going to burn it, maybe the amount of silicon, for instance, might be important. If you're going to turn it into ethanol, then the way that it's going to be pretreated, the type of enzyme that's going to be used to digest that, the specific composition might have to do with the type of microbe that you use to ferment the biomass in the stover. So does the microbe ferment both 6 and 5 carbon sugars or only 6 carbon sugars? And then there's issues, too, in terms of how these different traits can be deployed. Is it going to be through breeding, through qualitative trait analysis? What's the possibility for transgenes? So many of these species, grass species, for instance, switchgrass, other grass species, it's very unclear whether transgenes are going to be acceptable within the context of politics, within the context of consumers, even though that might be a very good path for some of these more complex polyploid organisms. Finally, when we look at the sustainability standpoint, as I said, within the Great Lakes Bioenergy Center, there's been substantial discussion. We get into the question of how do you weight sustainability traits? So maybe with carbon sequestration, there might be a clearer path in terms of valuing this particular parameter, nitrogen efficiency. There's a value of the amount of nitrogen you put on. But when you look at things that ecosystem services, bird and insect diversity, other types of ecosystem services, it's very hard to decide how to value one ton per hectare versus some of these types of services, although they're going to be very important in the final analysis. And so these are some of the traits, deciding what our selection index is, how are we going to account for all these traits. Another challenge is developing ways to do the phenotyping that we need. There's certainly challenges when you breed for biomass. It's fairly easy to be quite successful at getting much larger plants, but the equipment that you use to harvest these plants and so on might not stand up and might not be built to handle the type of biomass that you have. On the left here, we have a picture of a combine we're trying to develop that'll separate the grain and then weigh the stover in the back, it's looking promising, but there's certainly been some hiccups along the way in trying to get that work, so adapting a prototype to a new purpose. Also within the center, here's another example of a phenotyping technology, a robot that can rapidly go through samples. And it takes very small, 1 gram, a few grams of samples, and can do thousands of samples. But part of the discussion we had with a technology like this is we have very large corn plants that come from very large plots. How do you get the sample down to that size and get this kind of throughput? So lots of logistics to figure out in terms of phenotyping. When we start with new traits, again, we have to start from the beginning. All the basic information is missing: heritabilities, correlations, QTL models, gene action. And again, this issue of transgenics: can we manipulate things through transgenics? Do we operate solely through breeding? All of these things are very important as you look at programs that are going to take a long term and require a large investment. So a little bit about technology. I think there'll be a number of talks that relate to this. I think one of the very interesting things is the amount of information that can be leveraged from model crop species. And so here is a little phylogeny of grasses highlighting some of the more well-developed genetic systems: rice, Brachypodium, maize, and that are examples that are models for some of the other species like switchgrass and miscanthus. I have here, so this is a picture, of course, of some famous maize geneticists kind of contrasting species that have had a lot of work versus species that are very new. So if you look at switchgrass, some of these prairie grasses, they're really very early in the domestication process. And it's not really a 100-year difference. It's probably about a 10,000-year difference where humans have really been focusing on breeding these species. And so you have a big difference in terms of the improvement. But the exciting thing in terms of genomics and DNA and so on is that very rapidly you can develop the tools to look at markers, look at transcriptomes, look at genomic constitution, at least the gene space of these species, and that's possible because you can leverage that information, both because of what you can do just de novo, but also because you can leverage that information against these much more well-characterized species, and this extends to Arabidopsis and other species as well. Also in this context, there'll be a talk, I took this picture from the Wilkerson group, but you can go far beyond the species that you're interested in. You can choose species that are very rich in particular tissues and are very rich in particular types of compounds, and this has been a useful strategy to discover new types of genes that might work in your crop to perhaps put a new type of bond in a lignin that isn't existing within near relatives of the species you're working on, or somehow manipulate the cell wall. And so, like I said, there's a lot more detail to come on this. But the basic point here is that the analysis of DNA allows us to extend far beyond the species that we're focusing on. And one of the really exciting things for me is the dense information that we're having, the resequencing information on the whole genomes. Many of us have worked for a number of years with RFLPs or SSRs, other markers of this type, and basically I look at those as mile markers along a very long highway. And now we're getting down to the pebbles, to the individual base pairs across many, many species. So we can resequence within species that have a reference genome. We're developing this very deep sequence information across many, many different organisms. With this opportunity comes new challenges, methods of analysis, computation, bioinformatics. So we're used to using Excel spreadsheets. Now we're exceeding the capacity of the Excel spreadsheets. You want to transfer data. There was a talk this morning where they're sending hard disks between the United States and China because it takes too long to transfer the data back and forth. And so it's data manipulation, data storage, all becomes an issue. With the technology, you still have to identify appropriate germplasm. You still have to generate very high-quality phenotypic data. And actually, I think this is the bigger challenge, that the phenotypic data now is becoming very expensive. Just one example of how this might have an impact on the research. As I said, the phenotyping is expensive if we can get higher marker density. So here we took just an example, one chromosome from a population, a recombinant inbred line population for a developmental trait. It doesn't matter exactly what it is. But if you have 200 markers along your chromosome, in this case, we weren't able to detect the QTL at all. If you go up to 2,000 markers, you can detect this very large effect on this particular chromosome. Your confidence interval includes about a megabase and 50 gene models. And if you go up to 25,000 markers using the same phenotypic data, now you can reduce that confidence interval substantially and get closer to the genes that you're interested in. And of course, this is just the tip of the iceberg. It's not only getting more power within your populations, but you can begin to look across populations because now you have the haplotypes to combine analyses and so on, and this is going to further increase your power. So this is all very exciting, and you know, I think many of us said, well, there's numbers of QTLs that are being cloned, quantitative trait nucleotides, but of course, as you get more and more information, you get more and more power, and what we begin to learn is that actually the QTL with large effects are very few and far between, and many genes, as we knew, are controlled by, or many traits are controlled by many genes with small effects. And so this is going to argue, I think, more for genome-wide selection, less of trying to actually get to the basis of these quantitative trait nucleotides, quantitative trait genes. A little bit on pathways. So a lot of reverse genetic work going on. So there's a lignin pathway is one example where people are making very good discoveries in terms of manipulating this pathway, reducing the amount of lignin, changing the types of lignin, and that's affecting the recalcitrance or the digestibility of the particular feedstock that's produced. But I think it's also important to point out that there's a role for forward genetics as well, that there's some pathways we know, there's different systems that we understand, but there's a lot we don't know. And this is a photo from Ken Vogel and Gautam shows selection in grasses for high and low lignin, and you can see in this particular example you have substantial differences in the anatomy of the plant. And so in some cases it might be biochemistry, in some cases it might be anatomy. We did similar things. So this is a paper that Natalia's group wrote on the breakdown of corn plants. And so if you look at the proportion of different components of a corn plant, roughly 50% is stalk, a little bit of tassel, some cob, husk and shank, midrib, leaf blade, and leaf sheath. And if you look at the digestibility, so the higher the numbers here, the better the feedstock is for ethanol or for animal feed. You see that the leaves and the leaf sheaths are much more digestible than stalk, for instance. And so if you could manipulate the proportions of those, then you could increase perhaps the digestibility of the plant. I made a little quick back of the envelope calculation here. BM3 is a mutant in the lignin pathway. It's something that's been existing in corn for a long time. And just comparing a couple pairs of isolines, Natalia gave me some information that increases this value, NDFD, 10 to 20%. When I looked across the different genotypes that we'd gathered and said, well, how much can we increase the proportion of leaf blade and leaf sheath? It looks certainly reasonable to increase that by 50%, so to raise this 12% to 18%, this 12% to 18%, and then proportionately reduce those. So then I took those frequencies times the values here and asked, well, how much would that change digestibility? So by increasing this particular developmental parameter, that changed the digestibility by about 5%. And so you can start to make these types of calculations, and you know, there's of course various complexities, but it helps you decide on the trade-offs. Now, some of these genes, of course, have pleiotropic phenotypes on yield and performance and so on, and so there might be also choices to choose one path over the other. The last thing I have here, I think some of the really exciting opportunities are targeted trait improvements, specifically extending the range of variation outside of what we see within an existing species. So breeding will take us so far, but within a species, there's genes that might not exist. There's types of biochemical linkages that might not exist. And so one of the really exciting things, I think, is to introduce new variation and work with that within a species. Transgenes, while there's certainly concerns about acceptance, clearly simplify the inheritance of traits, and so that's one advantage of those. And in addition, I think we can add traits that add value to the particular feedstocks that we're developing. And I think the talk from Michigan State will probably address some of the exciting things about oil as well. So, in summary, this is a time really of great excitement and possibility. I'm excited about the amount of funding for basic and applied plant research. There's opportunities for really the whole continuum of people to work on plant research. Unprecedented information on genetic variation, gene expression, we're measuring phenotypes in ways that also provides extensive data sets. I think it's an unusual opportunity to vision and create. We're moving to really a new system, and you see really lots of innovation, lots of ideas being tossed around, and I think that's really very exciting as well. However, the fact remains that many paths are viable, and that really reduces the efficiency of attaining any specific goal. We have all this sandbox of research going on, and hopefully some important trends will emerge there, but we're clearly not moving all in one direction. We don't have specific phenotypes we're trying to get to. We don't have specific systems that we're working in the context of. And that, in the broadest sense, that reduces the efficiency of developing a system. But that's the time that we're at, you know, and I think that's ultimately as the ethanol plants get built, as the technologies begin to be stabilized, then a lot of the things that are being discovered now can be considered in that new context. So that's all I have.
Thank you very much.